Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, the corporate side of storm recovery, subways and rising sea levels, and some music to do your politics by. We've got a studio session with the National straight ahead. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts designed with convenient features to help reach savings goals. To learn more or open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Thursday, the 1st of November. Glad to have you with us. Natural disasters do tend to bring out the good in people, don't you think? Neighbors helping neighbors, everybody pitching in, that kind of thing. May well turn out to be true of companies, too. AT&T and T-Mobile have a new thing going on in New York and New Jersey. No roaming fees if you're a customer of one using the network of the other. Companies helping companies, helping consumers, sure, and some pretty good publicity, too. Marketplace's David Gura gets us going.
AT&T and T-Mobile have played nice before. They'd planned to merge, but the Fed shut down that deal last year on competitive grounds. And just like that, a wireless rivalry was reborn.
Hi, I'm a T-Mobile MyTouch 4G.
And I'm an iPhone 4.
So, iPhone, where's your shirt?
Oh, yeah, I had to give it to AT&T here for my data plan.
Analyst John Byrne says this kind of post-Sandy cooperation may look good, but it's also necessary. Sandy strained both networks by knocking out cell phone towers across the mid-Atlantic.
You have both a supply issue where there's not enough towers and a demand issue where people are using their phones more than they normally would.
Burton says this is the first time he's seen wireless carriers collaborate after a natural disaster, and it's also rare in other sectors. Kelly McElhaney teaches at the Haas School of Business at Berkeley. She's also a consultant to companies on corporate responsibility issues.
Individuals, companies, certainly CEOs are trained to beat one another up in the marketplace. It's a dogfight.
But in the aftermath of disasters, McElhaney says, that can change.
We certainly saw it after 9/11 or the earthquake in Haiti, where you had technology companies coming together.
Working on software and infrastructure. But how long can corporate rivals like AT&T and T-Mobile sing Kumbaya? Peter Cohen is a management consultant.
Once the disaster's over, they'll part ways, but it seems like it's going to be months before they get all this stuff fixed.
The FCC estimates a quarter of the cell phone towers in the state Sandy hit hardest are out of commission. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
All right, so here's an actual neighbor-helping-neighbor story. Since Sandy left big chunks of New York in the darkness, we brought you tales of people on the move in search of a power outlet or dealing with hellish commutes to work. But consider those New Yorkers who are stuck, the elderly in particular, who live in high-rises without power. No lights, no electric stoves, no elevators to get out. It's a big problem. And today, the city stepped up efforts to get food and water to those most in need. Nonprofits are scrambling as well to make sure the elderly have something to eat. Marketplace's Mark Garrison went along for the ride, or to be more precise, the steep and very dark walk.
So we have one client that's in need of meals right now.
At City Meals on Wheels in Manhattan, volunteers Emily Rosansky and Eric Blumenfeld are getting their assignment from a staffer who shows them what's in the 8-pound boxes they'll be hauling.
Tuna crackers, applesauce, and we are also putting water.
Their first delivery is on the 25th floor. They're taking the stairs. Out on the street, we cross into the powerless part of Manhattan. The walk to the building isn't far, but we're all thinking about the walk up.
Right now, it seems like the tallest building I've ever seen, which is not true, but it's just because I know I'm going to walk up it. It feels intense.
City Meals, good afternoon. Can I help you?
And it's intense back at City Meals on Wheels, where they're making thousands more deliveries than normal. Executive Director Beth Shapiro says broken elevators make their job feeding homebound elderly even tougher.
We are seeing challenges that we've really not seen in years and years.
The nonprofit can't get enough donations or volunteers like Emery and Eric, who are walking those 25 dark and stuffy flights of stairs.
Okay, Eric, where are we now?
We are at the 15th floor, only 10 to go.
Cheerful guy, a marathoner, it turns out, so he sounds a lot better than Emery and I do once we're finally on the 25th floor.
I can't breathe, but I'm psyched. We're here.
And down will be better.
At the end of a dark hallway is the apartment where Gerald Lefkowitz rests in bed. He lives alone with dogs Morris and Jake.
Oh, thank you. It was very nice of you people.
25 flights down, and the volunteers are back on the street looking to their next upward hike.
Only 15 floors this time.
14th and 7th, they're as far west as you can go.
They hop into a cab, and they're off to the next hungry older person in a powerless building high above the streets. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, traders were indeed happy to be back in business this second session after Sandy. It's going to be the happy music when we get there. There was a key political development amid all the storm-related news out of New York and New Jersey today. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg endorsed President Obama for re-election in part because of the president's record on climate change. That's a not insignificant thing, coming from a guy whose subway system has spent the better part of 3 days underwater. Rising sea levels because of global warming are being blamed for making that flooding worse. It's a danger that was predictable, experts say, and predicted. From the Transportation Nation Project at WNYC in New York City, Andrea Bernstein reports.
On Monday night, as Sandy's storm surge hit, salt water rushed into all five subway tunnels linking Manhattan with Brooklyn. More people ride through those tunnels than ride through every other transit system in America. MTA Chief Joe Loda described the scene the next day.
The MTA last night faced a disaster as devastating as it has ever faced in its history.
By this morning, none of the five tunnels had reopened.
Ladies and gentlemen, there is no train service between Brooklyn and Manhattan.
Officials set up shuttle buses to replace the subways, but the transfers were choked.
If you're coming out of the subway station, it's that way to line.
It stretched fully around Brooklyn's brand new basketball arena.
You got to wait about an hour and a half to go around the block. And they're going back and forth. And before you know it, you're just dead tired. It's crazy.
There's a cost to all these disrupted commutes. Lost wages, lost business. Experts say it could run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. New York's governor, Andrew Cuomo, says New York has to rebuild its subway system to make it less vulnerable to storms like Irene and Sandy, which hit New York just 14 months apart.
Part of learning from this is the recognition that climate change is a reality, extreme weather is a reality. It is a reality that we are vulnerable.
Transportation officials have been monitoring the effects of rising sea levels on the subways. About a year ago, I spoke to Columbia University's Klaus Jacobs. He modeled a storm like Sandy and brought his findings to the MTA.
And there was a big silence in the room because the system is so old. Many of the items that would be damaged by the intrusion of the salt water into the system could not recover quickly.
Jacobs produced a subway map with the flooded lines colored in deep blue, looking like skeletal fingers under the East River. Last night, the MTA released its own map of the new subway. The closed lines almost exactly reflect Jacobs' model. MTA officials say they're checking each electrical component, and the subways won't be fully open until every part is checked. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
There was a big art and culture expo here in Los Angeles last year, a celebration of L.A. and Southern California art from 1945 through 1980. Pacific Standard Time was the title. We're talking months of events all over Southern California. And now the time has come to pay the piper, as it were, figure out the economic impact of a year's worth of art. Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji has the story.
Luis de Jesus owns one of the 70 art galleries that took part in Pacific Standard Time.
I remember the first time that I was taken to a museum. I was in kindergarten. And I remember being led with my classroom, everybody kind of holding hands, and seeing this huge painting of this giant lion kind of leaping out at me. And I was just so struck by that. I was like, oh my God.
De Jesus isn't sure you can put a price tag on the hundreds of thousands of oh my God moments that Pacific Standard Time events sparked at his gallery and all over town. According to the economic impact study released today, 1.8 million visitors came to Southern California's museums and galleries just for Pacific Standard Time. That's potentially a lot of oh my God. Jim Cuno's the president and CEO of the J. Paul Getty Trust. It launched the sprawling initiative that took 10 years of research and preparation.
People began to ask us, well, what's going to be the impact of this project? To which we always answered, there's going to be new scholarship developed. It's going to be disseminated broadly through publication and online. And lots of people are going to come to exhibitions and learn about this great artistic legacy that was endangered.
Cuno says, and then people would ask,
what difference is it going to make in the local economy?
The unemployment rate in Los Angeles during Pacific Standard Time was 12%, much higher than the national average. How to create jobs was the obsession, not how to celebrate art history. So the Getty had an outside organization crunch the numbers. The L.A. County Economic Development Corporation looked at 31 nonprofit cultural institutions that took part in Pacific Standard Time. Each detailed how many employees they hired, how much they spent on printing, on construction supplies, and food. Add to that visitor spending and...
From an economic point of view, of course, it was a good thing.
That's Christine Cooper, an economist who worked on the study.
We determined that the visitor spending and the institutional spending generated $280 million in economic output for the region and about 2,500 jobs.
Cuno, the CEO of the J. Paul Getty Trust, says, yes, those numbers are good, but...
I would just caution everyone to not confuse the benefits of artistic experiences with the economics of artistic experiences. They're not the same, but they do coexist.
He says the goal for the project was to expose Southern California and beyond to homegrown artistic excellence. He's so happy, Pacific Standard Time Part 2 is already in the works. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I don't presume to understand, you know, any kind of demographic. It's just usually an attempt to try to figure out myself.
The middle class, music, and the election. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, there you go. The Dow Industrials jumped 136 points today. 1% closed at 13,232. The NASDAQ up 42 points, 1.4%, 3020, 3020 at the bell. The S&P 500 added 15 points, 1%, 1427 is the number you're looking for there. The rally fed off positive economic reports about private sector job creation, factory activity, and consumer confidence, which hit its highest level since early 2008, by the by. That optimism spurred industrial stocks. Masco, which makes Delta faucets and Bear paint, climbed nearly 7% today. U.S. Steel picked up 5.2%. Blue chips also gained. Microsoft booted up 3.4%. Intel up nearly 3% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.73%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank, FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts with a competitive variable interest rate and convenient access via phone or web. Link your existing bank accounts without switching banks. To learn how this FDIC-insured high-yield savings account can complement your savings goals and to open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. A look at those unemployment lines. The Labor Department issues employment data for October, its last report before Election Day. The Commerce Department releases factory orders for September. And Howard Hughes' giant flying boat, the Spruce Goose, took its one and only flight 65 years ago. Flight time, about a minute. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Pretty much as soon as the winds from Sandy died down, or maybe before, actually, the more politically minded among us started trying to figure out what impact, if any, the storm would have on the election. Turnouts and attitudes and opinions, you know the list.
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup, whose business it is to know or know about those kinds of things. Frank, good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
So you have recovered from the storm, I gather?
Well, many of us, including me, in the central New Jersey region have no power, but it's not nearly as bad as it could be, so we're thankful that we're still moving around.
Sandy aside, what are you expecting turnout-wise on Tuesday, both overall and then for Democrats and Republicans?
Yeah, our overall headline was that voter turnout will likely fall short of 2000 or 2008. As usual, Republicans will turn out more than Democrats. That's also almost always the case.
Yeah, why is it that Republicans generally vote in higher numbers than Democrats?
That's a historic pattern. They tend to have higher levels of education. They tend to be more likely to be homeowners. They tend to have been in the same place longer than others. They tend to be older. And all of those characteristics are correlated with the higher probability of voting.
Which then poses the critical get-out-the-vote dilemma for the Democrats, right? And that's where sort of where we are now in the last 4 or 5 days.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. And I think if you interview the Obama team, they would say one of their central thrusts this entire campaign has been to get young voters, who always don't vote as much as older voters, and minorities and others to come out and vote in higher numbers because those are assured votes. But you have to get them to the polls before it counts.
How much do you think it matters, Frank, that a lot of the states up in that corner of the country are blue states, are going to go for Obama anyway?
Well, that's a very significant factor. You know, I heard some people opining that if the New York City area was really knocked out, New York State, all the upstate votes could carry it for Romney, but that's very unlikely. So it's significant because these states, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York in particular, are almost certainly going to go for Obama anyhow, even if their overall vote totals are down or even if the, you know, percent voting for Obama or Romney shifts around. Mm-hmm. So as far as the national Electoral College picture is concerned, this certainly has had less impact than, say, had something gigantic happened in Florida or in Ohio.
Right, right. What do you do on Election Day? I mean, it's all over but the counting for you, right?
That's right. You know, we do polling never on Election Day itself in history. So, yeah, we're sitting back with nothing to do but watch the returns come in. And, of course, being good citizens, vote ourselves.
That's right. Frank Newport, he's the editor-in-chief at Gallup. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
This is going to sound kind of obvious, I'll grant you, but when you go to the hospital, you expect to get better, right? Truth is, hundreds of thousands of people every year get worse. Infections, pneumonia, sometimes a patient falls and breaks a hip. All of which is to say hospitals have come to realize lots of these problems are preventable, which is good for patients and sometimes great for a hospital's bottom line. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Nobody knows exactly how many people in the U.S. die from the mistakes hospitals make, but Peter Pronovost at Johns Hopkins Institute for Patient Safety says what we do know is pretty scary.
100,000 people die from infections each year that hospitals or healthcare organizations give them. 100,000 die from blood clots. 80 to 100,000 die from misdiagnosis.
Pronovost says not all of those deaths are preventable, but most are. And there's the thousands who die from miscommunication errors and the treatment mistakes.
You add all those up, you end up with a third leading cause of death.
Pronovost says only cancer and heart disease kill more Americans every year than what's known as preventable harm, basically errors that could be avoided.
The problem we have in medicine is that it's viewed as a craft in which each doctor does each thing his or her own way.
Paul Levy is a former hospital CEO and a patient safety expert. He says to really tackle the problem, doctors and nurses need systems, kind of like airplane pilots.
We expect the pilot to follow, without variation, a certain checklist for doing the standardized things that need to be done. For much of medicine, we need to do the same thing.
It's 9:30 in the morning at Holy Redeemer Hospital in suburban Philadelphia. Staff members here are dialing into the daily safety call.
Hi, this is Annette reporting for IC. I have 2 safety issues to report.
These check-ins are just one way Holy Redeemer is trying to standardize care to improve patient safety. Figuring out protocols is not easy. Take patient falls. Holy Redeemer has tried a little bit of everything. Non-slip socks, lowering bed heights, alarms that go off when a patient gets up, and Andrew Zindel.
The gentleman I'm sitting with today, every time he tries to get up, I think about worrying about him trying to get up and fall.
That's right. In the 21st century, sometimes the best way to make sure someone doesn't fall is to pay a nurse's aide like Zindel to just sit there. While developing new standards obviously takes time and money, hospital executives have found where there are standards to plug in, it's worth it. Dr. Ken Sand says his hospital, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, had drawn up blueprints for a new intensive care unit. At the same time, the hospital began new protocols on ventilators, like raising patients up and brushing their teeth, and cases of related pneumonia fell by 2,000.
We were able to scrap that plan and save the institution tens of millions of dollars.
Hospitals are under pressure to eliminate preventable errors. If they don't, insurers and the federal government will make hospitals pay for it. Healthcare executives agree saving money alone won't inspire doctors and nurses to do the hard work to improve patient safety. Holy Redeemer's chief safety officer, Karen Renson, says management must remind staff why they're there, to help, not harm. Renson herself gave a patient the wrong medicine 30 years ago.
I'll never forget the way it makes you feel. You want to die. The whole bottom of your stomach falls out. You feel like, I'm not going to be a nurse anymore. I'm giving this up. I got to figure out something else I want to do.
Renson says the reality is that as long as human beings are working on other human beings, mistakes will be made. But she says that doesn't mean there's no point in trying. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
And now, a diversion of sorts.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
It comes from our Wealth and Poverty Desk, and we're going to do something a little bit different on the show. Policy with a melody to it. Kind of an election year mixtape. Our reporter Chrissy Clark goes back a long way with some of the guys in the indie rock band The National. Five guys who are all big Obama supporters and who all grew up in a certain Midwestern swing state that's getting a whole lot of attention right now. Chrissy spent a day with them in the recording studio last week.
You can't record a song on an empty stomach. So while the rest of the band's tuning up in the studio, I find Matt Berninger, the National's lead singer, eating a breakfast that he's not at all ashamed of.
Puffins. Multigrain puffins.
He washes that down with a bottle of San Pellegrino, which one of his bandmates, Aaron Dessner, teases him about over the piano.
It's a little bourgeois to be able to drink Pellegrino.
A little bourgeois. Matt laughs. He's pretty self-aware about that kind of stuff already, he tells me, when we go out to the yard behind the studio. This is a guy who sings about how he's pink and young and middle class.
Yeah, I mean, like to say the word middle class in a rock song does seem kind of lame.
Or awesome, depending
maybe.
to the Marketplace audience.
Yeah, I don't presume to understand, you know, any kind of demographic. It's just usually an attempt to try to figure out myself.
Check.
And that's exactly what happened in the song Blood Buzz, Ohio.
Stand up straight at the foot of your love. I lift my shirt up.
Matt says he started writing it as a love song. Lines about over-the-top teenage heartache.
Some fantasy of a high school sweetheart. I didn't really have one in high school, but
lift my shirt.
Meanwhile, as he was writing the song, he also happened to be in a lot of credit card debt. He found ways to manage it, thankfully. His music career had just taken off, but he was still frustrated.
Just kind of desperate. Every time I thought I was on top of it, something would happen, and, you know, it's this cycle that starts to eat itself, and you start to slip.
So one day, he scribbled this line in his songwriting notebook.
I still owe money to the money, to the money I owe.
He read it again later and put a big star next to it. Thought, that line kind of hits on something that a lot of Americans were facing at the time. Eventually, he fleshed it out into a lyric.
I still owe money, to the money I owe. The floors are falling out from everybody I know. I'm on a blood buzz.
Matt, by the way, made up the word blood buzz.
You're on, you know, like on a wine buzz or vodka buzz or a blood buzz.
And since Matt and all his bandmates were born in Ohio.
Ohio's in our blood.
I was carried to Ohio.
The band recorded Blood Buzz Ohio in 2010 in the depths of the recession. Notice if you say Ohio enough times, it kind of rhymes with I-O. Matt says his home state lends itself to metaphor.
The microcosm of America, in a way, how divided it is. Politically, economically. Growing up middle class, my parents, we never talked about money stresses. But I guess the truth is like when you don't think about it, you must be in a class that's well off enough not to worry.
But there are very few people in this country that don't worry all the time.
Especially now, Matt says. He's gotten a window seat on the effects of the Great Recession over the last few years, touring the country on a comfy bus with his band. He's doing well, but the middle-class America of his childhood that flicks past him on the highway, it doesn't look so good.
So many foreclosure signs, so many towns you go through, and there used to be a lot of businesses on the street, and now there's two. In this country, I think it's way too easy to go from being fine to suddenly being ruined.
Lay my head on the hood of your car, take it to...
Matt thinks any song worth its salt is about more than one thing at the same time. Heart of Blood Buzz Ohio is about personal nostalgia.
You realize that there's something that's gone that you miss, and it's mostly the younger version of yourself.
But maybe it's also the younger version of America. Back when middle-class boys from Ohio didn't worry so much about the floor falling out. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
We've got a video of Blood Buzz Ohio that the guys recorded just for us. Also, our complete interview with the National on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up tomorrow, Nashville and this election. The soundtrack of the GOP, you might have noticed, has an awful lot of twang to it.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, back to the story we started with, AT&T and T-Mobile joining forces after Sandy, at least for a little while. We went out on Twitter this morning, asked you what mashup of corporate rivals would make your lives easier. Here's just a couple of them. Taco Bell and Zipcar. Okay, I can see that. Amazon and Costco. I'd love to have the UPS guy deliver 16 gallons of gas, 36 rolls of toilet paper, and a 20-pound bag of rice was another. Disney and Lucasfilm. Oh, no. Never mind on that one. Jack White and Jay-Z. And then this one, the best one, from a guy named Christopher Taws. Republicans, he said, and Democrats. So there you go. All right, that's Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Same time, same place tomorrow. See ya. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.